A greedy man owned a vineyard and rented it to some farmers, so they could work it and he could collect its crop from them. He sent his slaves so the farmers would give him the vineyard's crop. They grabbed him, beat him, and almost killed him, and the slave returned and told his master. His master said, perhaps he didn't know them. He sent another slave, and the farmers beat that one as well. Then the master sent his son and said, perhaps they'll show my son some respect. Because the farmers knew that he was the heir of the vineyard, they grabbed him and killed him. Whoever has ears to hear should listen.
And that's the parable of the vineyard, found in four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and Thomas, the one that was just read. Because of the way the Gospel writers interpreted this parable, it's become an allegory in which God is the owner, the vineyard is Israel, the farmers are the temple authorities or the religious leaders, the slaves are the prophets, and the son, Jesus. That's how it's largely been interpreted throughout the history of interpretations, beginning with many of the gospel writers themselves. This other version read in the Gospel of Thomas, the fellows of the Jesus Seminar said that's probably closer to the original parable that Jesus told. There's no allegory attached to the Thomas reading. And in the Thomas reading, the parable ends, anyone here with two ears had better listen, but there's a line before that. That is in the other Gospels. It probably is what Jesus said to end the question. He tells a parable, and then he says, what then will the owner of the vineyard do after all this killing? Rule of thumb, remember with Jesus' parables, kings, judges, landowners, not to be equated with a God figure. Now, the Gospel writers do that, and the later interpretive tradition has done that, but when we get back to the figure of Jesus, we find that the parables were far more subversive and far more practical. I find that many of the parables of Jesus were not theological allegories as much as practical wisdom to those who suffered from injustice. And as I've been mentioning, the person who has helped me a lot in the study of parables is William Herzog. His book is Parables as Subversive Speech, Jesus as Pedagogue of the Oppressed. Now, another interesting detail that could be related with the original telling is found in Mark and Matthew. Each gospel writer begins their parable this way. Someone planted a vineyard, put a hedge around it, dug a wine press, built a tower, leased it out to some farmers, and then went abroad. So Jesus is telling a parable to people who know all about vineyards and absentee landlords. From the people's perspective, the landowners aren't the good guys. And so if Jesus' audience is largely made up of the peasant class, or 80% of the population, they would identify with the farmers. Where did the landowner get the land to build this luxury vineyard? Land stayed in the family for generations. The only way you get land is to take it. And Herod funded his huge building projects, including the temple, by forcing peasants off their land to then work for the new large landowners for the purpose of making cash crops like wine. So this parable of Jesus reflects this reality as a conflict between a ruling class and the peasant class. Of course, this process of taking land preceded Herod. In Isaiah chapter 5, there's an interesting parallel to our parable that provides a hint of its context. God is speaking, supposedly, in this parable. My beloved had a vineyard on a very fertile hill. He dug it, cleared it of stones, planted it with choice vines, built a watchtower in the midst of it, hewed out a wine vat in it. He expected it to yield grapes, but it yielded wild grapes. The metaphor of wild grapes is social injustice. Wild grapes is the metaphor for social injustice. A few verses later, we read this. Ah, you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there is room for no one but you, and you're left to live alone in the midst of the land. The consolidating of the land for Isaiah, and I believe for Jesus in this parable and the situation, is the injustice. And so Jesus speaks in the tradition of the prophets of justice. The dream of these prophets is that one day everyone will sit under his or her own fig tree. The land would be returned. Everyone would have a space and a place. So in our parable, one of the important questions is, well, whose land is it? Does it belong to the guy who planted the vineyard? Or does it belong to the peasants who were forced off? We can have an opinion, but we can imagine there would be debate. Who owns Israel-Palestine today? Who owns Egypt? Who owns Syria or the Gulf of Mexico? Who owns the Oregon coast? Who owns the Columbia River? Who owns the trees and the birds? The water, the air, the soil, the seed? Who owns the carbon beneath the ground? A few weeks ago, I included a poem in the bulletin that was written by Ernesto Cardenal. It's called Unrighteous Mammon. I want to read this again. In respect of riches, then, just or unjust, of goods, be they ill-gotten or well-gotten, all riches are unjust, all goods ill-gotten, if not by you, by others. Your title deeds may be in order, but did you buy your land from the true owner? And he from its true owner? And the latter? Though your title go back to the grant of a king, was the land ever the king's? Has no one ever been deprived of it? And the money you receive legitimately now from client or bank or national funds or from the U.S. Treasury, was it ill-gotten at no point? Yet do not think that in the perfect communist state, Christ's parables will have lost relevance, or Luke 16:9 have lost validity, and riches be no longer unjust, or that you will no longer have a duty to distribute riches. What do we think, we humans, when considering the scale of a 4.5 billion year old Earth, in the midst of a universe three times older than that, that we little ants who've been here for but a microsecond can think we own any of it? The hubris is comical if it weren't tragic. Yet those with power and creative deviousness get their retainers, the political representatives to pass law after law to put air, water, land, and life itself on the balance sheet of a corporation. If there is a text that transcends time, it would be these words from Isaiah. Ah, you who join house to house, who add field to field, until there's room for no one but you, and you're left to live alone in the midst of the land. Don't ever think for a minute that the God envisioned in the Bible favors any group of people, whether that group be of a certain ethnicity or religion or social status. The biblical vision, both Testaments and the Quranic vision, is not one of a particular people having a divine right to land or any of Earth's bounty. The biblical vision is that human beings have the privilege of being stewards of justice. Since it's graduation Sunday, I feel an obligation to say something on behalf of our fine graduates and all those listed in the bulletin, our high school ones and college ones and everything. I'm not going to tell you to follow your dreams or any other such whatever. I'm going to instead make my previous point again. In the end, you have the right to absolutely nothing. The universe owes you nothing. You do, however, have the privilege, due to the amazing cosmic lottery that allowed for your improbable existence, to be a steward of justice. Now, the second bit of wisdom is that nothing is as straightforward as it seems. Look deeper. Doubt everything. In response to everyone's truth claim, including those who wear fancy robes, follow the money. Ask whose interest is served. And then, as a steward of justice, devote your lives to transform those small interests into the interests of all. You could do worse with your life. There's a context to this parable. There's a matrix. And that matrix is the injustice of land acquisition. It's not a straightforward business transaction of a landowner leaving the vineyard to the farmers and returning for an agreed-upon share. That's what it looks like. Even the tenants are labeled wicked. But looking deeper, this parable describes a peasant revolt. The parable codifies the spiral of violence. Elites expand their land at the expense of the peasants who are at subsistence levels. And this element of injustice wild grapes, to use the metaphor from Isaiah, is embodied within the system itself. This is the first level of violence. Herzog, who I've quoted before about this parable, writes, "The spiral begins in the everyday oppression and exploitation of the poor by the ruling elites. This violence is often covert and sanctioned by law, such as the hostile takeover of peasant land. More often than not, peasants simply adjust and adapt to these incursions by the elites in order to maintain their subsistence standard. But even peasants have their breaking point." And so then it moves to the second level in the spiral of violence, the peasant's response to the servant who comes to collect. We can imagine that disputes would arise when the servants or the retainers for the landowner come to collect the rent. Perhaps the rent's too much, or they're pushed to the point of frustration. In the parable, the farmers beat the servant and they send him away empty-handed. The spiral of violence escalates. The landowner sends another. Same thing. Violence increases. And now it gets serious. Finally, the landowner sends his son, the heir. The landowner's confident that by sending his son, the peasants will stop this revolt. And the master sent his son and said, "Perhaps they'll show my son some respect." Respect, read, superior firepower. But they don't. The landowner means business. But the peasants are feeling their oats. And the revolt is getting heady. And they say to themselves that if they kill the son, they'll take the land back. The landowner will give up. And so they do. They kill the son, and the parable ends. First level of the spiral of violence is the violent that is embedded in the injustice, the wild grapes of oppression and exploitation, which people don't see unless you're in it. The second level is of the spiral of violence is the peasant revolt that leads to the climax in which the son is killed. And then Jesus ends the parable by asking, well, what would the owner of the vineyard do? Will he give up and let the peasants take back the land and leave his son unavenged? Not likely. Will he respond with crushing violence? More likely. And that's the third level of the spiral of violence, a crushing response. Herzog makes this chilling observation that in ancient societies, there were many peasant revolts, but there were no peasant revolutions. The powers were simply too overwhelming. So, why does Jesus tell this really depressing parable? Before answering that, I want to talk about another parable of Jesus, one you may not have heard. It's found only in the Gospel of Thomas. It's called the Parable of the Assassin. It sounds surprising to come from Jesus, but here we go. The realm of God is like a person who wanted to kill someone powerful. While still at home, he drew his sword and thrust it into the wall to find out whether his hand would go in. Then he killed the powerful one. Then there's another saying that may or may not go back to Jesus, but it might help make sense of both the parable of the assassin and the vineyards, and it's found only in Luke chapter 14. Jesus says, "What king would go to war against another king and not first sit down and figure out whether he would be able with 10,000 men to engage an enemy coming against him with 20,000. If he decided he could not, he would send an envoy to ask for terms of peace while the enemy was still a long way off." Why did Jesus tell this parable? One more illustration before I get to that question. I highly recommend the documentary Eyes on the Prize. Anyone seen that, Eyes on the Prize? Well, we need to watch this. It's a documentary of the civil rights movement. It was created in the 1980s. And this parable of Jesus, especially his last line, "What will the owner of the vineyard do?" reminds me of a scene in the documentary where Andrew Young describes the aftermath to Bloody Sunday. Remember Andrew Young? He was a diplomat back in the 70s. He was a minister, politician, and so forth, and he was with King. And Bloody Sunday was the name given to the brutal police response to the march to Selma across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, a bridge still named for Edmund Pettus, a known Ku Klux Klanner. Alabama still has a way to go. The marchers, women, children, young boys, unarmed, were met by the police in riot gear on horses. Andrew Young and the other leaders thought that they would meet the police, you know, probably a few get arrested and then go back. But what happened is that they underestimated the brutality of racism. Tear gas, beating with clubs, chasing the marchers down on horseback. 50 people were sent to the hospital. After this attack, Andrew Young talks about what happened next at the church. They went back to the church to talk about what was going on. And this is from the documentary. Andrew Young here. Well, basically, we trained people to think rather than react. And the women and children, see, there weren't really many big, burly, able-bodied men. They were mostly young boys. And there was, the odds were outmatched, you know. I think if there had been any black man with a machine gun, then he might have done something. But blacks had no available arms, and here were people who were well-armed. And we always trained people that the one thing that the police could not deal with was nonviolence. That they could deal with violence, and that all you had to do was for one person to fire a shot, and that gave them an excuse to mow down hundreds of people. And we were very pragmatic and practical about it. And we explained violence in the kind of situation in which we lived as suicidal. And that it required, I think the term that Bevel used to use was a kind of revolutionary patience. That you know that you just didn't respond. Occasionally people would, you know, jump up and want to talk bad. And there were people who came back to the church and started talking about going to get their guns. And you had to talk them down. And you had to talk them down by simply asking questions. Well, what kind of gun you got? 32? 38? You know, how's that going to hold up against an automatic rifle and a 12-gauge? You know, 10-gauge shotguns that they've got. How many have you got? There are at least 200 shotguns out there with buckshot in them. And you ever seen buckshot? You ever seen what buckshot does to a deer? You know, and most of them had. And you make people think about the specifics of violence. And then they realize how suicidal and nonsensical it is. Andrew Young talking about what he had to do after Bloody Sunday to the African Americans who were mad enough, righteously so, to kill. Now, I'm speculating, but I see this parable of Jesus kind of like Andrew Young's speech to the young men who wanted to get their guns. You can imagine Jesus telling this parable about farmers beating up the landowner's retainer and the audience saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And as it escalates, more slaves beaten, even the son killed, and the crowd gets excited. Yeah, you're right, Jesus. It's time for a revolution. And then Jesus, I imagine, after a long pause, ends his story with a question. So now what do you think the vineyard owner will do? In other words, have you really thought this through? This revolution you got cooking? I think that Jesus told these parables to an audience of exploited and oppressed people to communicate a few things. One, I'm with you, I'm on your side. The realm of God is when we have our daily bread, and the land is returned, and there is restorative justice. Blessed are you who are poor and who are hungry now, who are oppressed now, you will be satisfied. It's clear that Jesus was an advocate for those who were oppressed by the elites, whether the elites were fellow Jews, Romans, or religious leaders. He had sympathy, he had compassion, he was one of them. Second, I think Jesus wanted to tell them to be smart and be cool. Before you decide to take on these guys, count the cost. Have a plan and don't underestimate your enemy. Even an assassin makes sure he can get the job done before he tries it. Even a king with an army makes sure he has enough troops first, and if not, makes terms for peace. So it's great, and I'm all for you leading a revolt against wealthy landowners and brutal dictators, but remember, that's why they call them brutal dictators in the first place. Taking on the powerful head-to-head doesn't end well. If you act violently, what will the owner of the vineyard do? And third, I think Jesus communicated something else, and it isn't in the parable itself. It's in the thought process that we have after it's done. It's in the very questions that you're having in your head right now. Well, what do we do? What do we do to injustice? If not with violence, how do we take on the powerful one? How do we effectively respond to injustice? How do we transform it? I think Jesus wanted to channel their righteous anger toward a third way. The way of resistance, but a way that did not escalate the spiral of violence. And the story of Jesus that's preserved is that he did enact this third way by example. He never allowed anyone to take away his dignity, even though they could harm his body. He didn't take on violence directly. He didn't respond to violence with violence. He was nonviolent, and yet he was executed. But his death came to mean far more than it would have had he been a violent bandit. Oscar Romero talks about just a few days before he was assassinated that if he were, it would be an honor to serve God in that way because he would rise up in the body of the people, continuing to fight nonviolently for justice. Andrew Young put it very well, revolutionary patience. But that isn't something that people tell the oppressed. It only comes from the oppressed telling one another. The model of nonviolent resistance is still in its infancy. And as an infant, it must be cradled, nurtured, fed, blessed, and given every opportunity to grow. This is the spiritual path of compassion and justice making. I was speaking with Krista Tippett, who hosts the NPR show On Being, and we were discussing her book, Becoming Wise, and her chapter on love. She used the term muscular love. And we were discussing Jesus' command to love enemies. And she said, I don't think we've even tried that. And if it's something possible, it will have to be something muscular and resilient. And she went on to say a little history of the church. The church left the public sphere in the early 20th century, and then it came back in the latter part of the 20th century, but it used its public voice on narrow issues, specific issues, trying to squeeze into a particular political box. She said, what if, when Christian voices had reinserted themselves into American political life, that it had been done in such a way that we all would have learned what love of enemy could look like in public life and in politics? What if love of enemies, nonviolent resistance, what if we modeled that? Jesus did. He told his parables to show his friends that violence does not bring about a lasting and just peace, whether done by empire or by peasants. It only escalates it. Peaceful alternatives to war and violence are not very flashy or terribly exciting. Maybe they need a little media hype. I don't know. But war and violence will not lead the world to the security we seek. And for our graduates, I have one more thing. No wisdom or advice, simply a request. I hope that you won't consider graduation as a graduation from church or from communities of conscience, whatever they may be for you. Humanity needs you to call back this institution to its purpose, to be the voice, the brain, the hands, and the feet of love of enemies, of a muscular love. Amen.